Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
Welcome to Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. 3 weeks ago, Governor Bob McDonnell signed an executive order creating an independent bipartisan redistricting commission. The 11-member commission is purely advisory in nature and has voted to hold its meetings in public, the first of which was held Monday. Joining us for this discussion of Virginia's legislature and its work this winter and spring is Governor Bob McDonnell. Governor, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bob. I appreciate having the opportunity to be back on with you.
It's a pleasure to have you back as a guest. I'm your host, Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorenson Institute for Political Leadership at the University of Virginia. Please give us a call at 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397 if you have a question for Governor Bob McDonnell. Governor, some members of the Virginia General Assembly doubt that your 11-member bipartisan redistricting commission will have any significant impact on the usually quite partisan remapping of the state's legislative and congressional districts all across Virginia. How can you guarantee the commission will have a real impact on the maps the Assembly passes in April?
Well, I can't make guarantees because this is the first time in history it's ever been done. What I can say is I have appointed 11 exceptional people, members of both parties. It is an equal amount from each party, and a talented chairman, Bob Holdsworth, who I know you know well, who's a straight shooter. And these are all people, former cabinet secretaries, civil rights lawyers, former members or directors of the state board of elections. I mean, people that really know these issues well, that are respected on both sides of the aisle. Now, what I've tasked them to do is very clear in an executive order is to essentially take the parameters in the law and the Constitution on redistricting, and that is the districts are supposed to be compact, contiguous, reflect communities of interest, honor the Voting Rights Act, and things of that nature, and then facilitate citizen input, and then submit a plan or plans and evaluate other plans. There are going to be numerous plans from colleges around the state, it looks like, through a competition, maybe some other interest groups. We'll have a plan. But I look at this as a very vital role in assisting the General Assembly in redoing these lines. Bob, as you know, this is the first ever redistricting that's going to be bipartisan because it's being done with a split legislature for 150 years.
The Senate being in Democratic hands and the House
exactly.
In Republican hands.
Never had that before. In every other year, it's been controlled by one party, the Democrats for about 140 years and the Republicans in the last one in 2000. And so inherently, this will be bipartisan, and what I expect these individuals to do with the help of people at CNU and Region and George Mason with their computer information is to craft a plan that will honor those principles in the Constitution and the statutes, and on an advisory basis then present that to the General Assembly for their benefit in drawing the line. I think it will be helpful. I've talked to the legislators and said I'm serious about doing this, and I think if they do their product well, I hope you will pay attention to their advice.
How can Virginia citizens make a difference in the partisan redistricting process? And if so, you know, should they go to the Citizens Advisory Commission, the bipartisan
yes.
commission, or should they also go to the legislature, which is actually charged with drawing the maps?
Both. And here's why. The Citizen Commission, the Bipartisan Redistricting Commission, will be holding public meetings and public hearings at different places around the state. They'll be widely publicized and announced. They are tasked with being a conduit for citizen input, unfettered by me or the legislature. This is not a governor's plan. This is not a General Assembly plan. It is these citizens' advice based on the input they get from the from the citizens. Secondly, is the General Assembly, once they introduce a bill, will then have public hearings around the state. I imagine both houses and hopefully both parties, Bob, will hold hearings on the plans or plans that are introduced so the citizens can comment on the specific bill before they vote. So I think there will be now two major opportunities for citizens to engage in the redistricting process.
What do you think of the idea of taking the redistricting process out of the legislature through a commission, a bipartisan commission or a nonpartisan commission, the way a few other states do it, an idea that would require amending the Constitution of Virginia?
Yeah, I haven't I have not supported that in the past. I think what I have done this year is a way to facilitate citizen input. It is very clear, and as you pointed out, by Constitution, that is the legislature that is tasked with redrawing its lines and the congressional district lines. That's what people elect legislators to do, to make tough decisions on everything from transportation to jobs to the death penalty to redistricting. And they're hired to use their best judgment to do all those things and to do it in a way that's consistent with the law. So I would hate to take that completely away, give it to an independent group, which, by the way, is going to carry its own biases or political affiliations into that. There's no guarantee of any true measure of independence. But I'd hate to do that when the legislature ultimately is tasked with doing this and doing it right. What I just insist upon is that they do follow the law, that they don't do some of this dramatic gerrymandering, which is what has undermined citizen trust in the overall process, and that they do respect compactness and contiguous land masses and communities of interest. If they do that well with the input of this panel, I think they'll have a good product.
You're listening to Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. My guest is Governor Bob McDonnell. Governor, let's go to the phones. Our first caller is Andy in Portsmouth. Andy, welcome to Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio.
Thank you. Governor McDonnell, I have one statement before I go into my question on transportation.
Okay.
I'm sure you're familiar with the article in the Virginia Pilot over the weekend about the amount of economic aid that has gone to various businesses in the state. And I wanted to point out something that wasn't really brought out in the article, is that a lot of money went to some rural areas, and simply put, there was a lot of bang for the buck in doing that. And I just wanted to say that I think that was one positive effect of all the economic aid that's gone out there.
Good.
My question regarding transportation, I do not know if you're aware, but Tim Miller, who lives in Richmond, he is in the process of trying to woo the 2015 World Championships of Cycling to Richmond, Virginia. And given that, what is cycling's role in the transportation plan for the Commonwealth of Virginia? Is anything going to be done to show that Virginia is a cycling-friendly state, considering we could be on the world stage for a very large event?
Thank you, Andy. Thanks for your call and your question, Governor.
Andy, I appreciate that. I can tell you that there is no express provision within this transportation reform bill for cycling per se. It is a $4 billion plan over 3 years that provides money from bonds and an infrastructure bank for roads, bridges, mass transit, and so forth. Now, there are other provisions of the law, however, in some existing programs within the Department of Transportation that do provide for various cycling paths, particularly in the cities where it can be a meaningful avenue to get people to and from work and obviously keep people off the roads. I'm particularly glad to know that this major economic development event may actually come to the city of Richmond in 2015. I appreciate Mr. Miller pursuing that. That's exactly the kind of thing that we want to be able to attract to our state, and I can say that the cycling and path, bike path, and historic trail programs that we have that facilitate bicycling is something that we will continue to support.
Governor, Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli has opined recently that it is unconstitutional for public dollars in Virginia to go to nonprofits. Are there any problems from that ruling?
Well, that's paraphrasing the express language of the Constitution that prohibits direct appropriations from the General Assembly.
Which Virginia's been doing for quite a while.
That's probably a fair statement. Legislatures for many, many decades have done that. We're evaluating his opinion to see what impact it has on any budget amendments that I proposed or anything that's in the existing budget. As you pointed out, there are many of those types of things, from food banks to various faith-based organizations and others that do receive state money. And so we're reviewing his opinion to determine whether or not we need to make any changes in the law. We obviously have already talked to the money committees in both houses and made them aware of the opinion, and after we finish reviewing it, I'll give my advice to the General Assembly on what things they should not do and what things they can do.
Governor Bob McDonnell is my guest on Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Let's go back to our callers. Our next caller is Joy in Harrisonburg. Joy, welcome to Assembly Conversations.
Hi.
Hi, Joy.
So I have a question for you dealing with your higher education proposal.
Yes.
During the State of the Commonwealth, I was really excited to hear that you were supporting more college education and making it more affordable and more accessible.
Yes.
One thing that you didn't address, however, was the lack of support for our teachers in these higher education institutions. And rather than them actually getting raises, we are, in fact, going to be getting a pay cut this year. How can you support higher education when by not paying salaries to teachers that are comparable around the country, you're going to be losing the good teachers to other states or other industries?
Well, first of all, Joy, if you are in the teaching profession, I want to say thank you. I salute you. My sister's a public school teacher in Amherst, and know from her how hard teachers work to pass on the knowledge and the values of the culture to the next generation. So I salute you for that. You know, there's only so many things you can talk about in the State of the Commonwealth speech. I have four major priorities this session: jobs, roads, transportation, and overall government reform, which is multifaceted, which includes pension reform and some things of that nature. We had a major K-12 education reform package my first session. So just not mentioning teacher pay, it certainly doesn't mean that I don't support teachers and K-12 education. We have a number of reforms we're proposing this year in the General Assembly. The speech just didn't allow time to cover all those things. I would say to you, Joy, what you're referring to as far as the cut is the fact that we have a retirement system that is not healthy at all. It's $17.6 billion underfunded. It'll go down to 61% funded by the year 2014, according to the last JLARC, the watchdog of the General Assembly's report. I'm not going to pass on this problem to another governor. I want to try to get it fixed because I owe you and I owe the state employees of Virginia the promise that when they retire that the money is going to be there for them to take care of their families. And I can't promise them there now because the pension system is so badly underfunded. And virtually every governor in the country is dealing with this. And so I'm taking it on and I'm being honest with our employees to say that if we're going to fix this problem, that I am asking our state employees to pay a little bit of money into the system. We're one of only four states where our employees pay nothing into the system. It's all paid by the state. And virtually no private sector employers have this. Most of them have defined contribution systems or require some payment from the employees. So, Joy, I know it's somewhat of a sacrifice to be able to be asked to pay a little more, but we are going to pay another 2% or so into the system. And my proposal will generate about $4.2 billion to start to reverse the slide and assure solvency of the system. So, Bob, I know I took a little bit of time with that, but it's an important question. I do support our teachers and our dedicated K-12 leaders, but we cannot pretend that we don't have a huge problem in our retirement system, and I intend to try to address it.
Thanks, Joy. Thanks for your call and your question. Governor, Virginia's prison population now exceeds 38,000 men and women, mostly men. That's up 26% since 2000, and the number on parole is also rising. That makes the Department of Corrections about Virginia's largest agency. Mm-hmm. Given the need to cut spending in the Commonwealth, what changes do you support?
Well, we're doing a number of things in the area of corrections. I've just hired a new Department of Corrections director who was the director in Massachusetts. He's a very innovative and creative person and shares my view that one thing we need to do better is to try to get people not to come back. The more we can cut down on recidivism, the more tax money we save, the less victims we have in the future. So we have launched a very aggressive reform dealing with prisoner reentry that I think will pay dividends in the future and cut down the need for prison space. Secondly, I'm restoring the rights of convicted felons at a significant rate to be able to give people a second chance and get them back to work so they don't recidivate. Thirdly, we want to make sure that we're doing smart things while people are in prison in order to try to get them the skills, the education, and things they need to be productive members of society. But at the same time, Bob, I am for 20 years since my start in public service as a prosecutor, I have been and will continue to be tough on people that violate the law, especially violent criminals. I expect them to serve long prison sentences. We've abolished parole. And as long as there are people that choose to violate the rights of others, we're going to keep them incarcerated for significant periods of time. But at the same time, I want to make sure they have every opportunity to be rehabilitated so they don't come back.
You're listening to Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Governor Bob McDonnell is my guest. Give us a call at 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397 if you have a question for the governor. Let's go to our next caller, who's Alex in Harrisonburg. Alex, welcome to Assembly Conversations with Governor Bob McDonnell. Alex, are you there?
Hello?
Alex, are you there?
Yes, hello?
You're on with the governor. Go right ahead.
Oh, hi. Hey, I'm a high schooler who bikes to school every day.
Yeah.
And I heard the previous question about biking, but I was wondering if you had any specific concrete changes in mind, and if you could expand on those in terms of, like, daily commuting and stuff.
Well, Alex, let me say how much I appreciate having a young person from high school paying attention to what's going on in state government and calling in on a show like this. I think that's terrific. Hey, let me turn it around the other way. I gave you an answer, but tell me, you must be a bicycler or cyclist yourself. What changes would you like to see maybe in Harrisonburg or around your community? What are we doing right? What are we not doing right? What would make your life a little easier if we could provide some additional services?
Well, there's no bike lanes like to anywhere near my school or to the school. There are some downtown, which is nice, but I don't think maybe there's not enough.
Okay.
I think it just needs support.
Well, Alex, I appreciate you bringing that to my attention. That's it's amazing. And already in 15 minutes, we've gotten several people interested in that. I will talk to our people in the Department of Transportation and make sure we are making that a visible part of our plan so young people like you that commute around the city by bike have more access. I appreciate your input.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks very much for your call and your question. Our next caller is Brett in Roanoke. Brett, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with Governor Bob McDonnell.
Thank you much for this service.
Hi, Brett.
Governor, it's hard to see the three new bridges out on 221 South in Roanoke as a public priority. In my opinion, it's a tragedy of great proportions. But my question is, will the public have a voice in the ongoing new bridge projects? And then I'll have a second one. Do you not see that it's important to respect our public radio as a public interest and keep it funded?
Well, thank you for your call. Virtually all road projects before they're built have multiple chances for public input, whether it's through the Commonwealth Transportation Board for the big projects at your local city council when they're doing or Board of Supervisors when they're doing the various permits through the federal NEPA process has a public comment period. Virtually all these major projects have an opportunity for public comment, and hopefully you have responsible leaders that will be taking that comment into account. With regard to public radio, I have great respect for what our public radio and television does. My problem is I'm managing the state of Virginia's budget. It's about $78 billion every 2 years. We've cut $10 billion out of that budget over the last couple of years. Right now, there are hundreds of radio stations and hundreds of TV stations that the average listener or viewer in the state can have access to. I grew up in an era when you had basically three main stations, and if you could get the rabbit ears right, you might get a UHF station. Bob, you probably remember that yourself.
I remember.
You're about my age. But the point is, in a free market right now, you've got so many choices. I don't think it's the role of government to subsidize one station, no matter how good they are. So Public radio and television has a great following. There are plenty of private sector donors that continue to support that venue. I just can't justify $4 million in support when there are so many critical underfunded needs that we've got already in Virginia. So it's a matter of priorities.
Thanks, Brett. Sure. Go right ahead.
The public comment was 25 years ago. It's an out-of-date project. We need to have current thinking on what our priorities are now.
Thanks, Brett. Thanks for your
Thank
call.
Thank you.
Governor, last week on Assembly Conversation, Secretary of Transportation Sean Connaughton was our guest and discussed transportation needs and funding. That show and this program will be available to listeners online at virginiapublicradio.org. I wonder what you think of Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli's bid to force the University of Virginia to hand over emails and records about climate change research. Would you have requested those 6 to 10-year-old emails yourself as Attorney General?
I don't know all the facts that the Attorney General knows. I can tell you as Attorney General, I use the subpoena duces tecum power in the civil investigative demand power regularly in any number of cases. Medicaid fraud and other cases our attorneys used all the time to do our job. So I don't know what all the information that he might have had available at his disposal. And, you know, my job is to get legal advice from the Attorney General, not to second guess what his decisions might have been. So I'm not in his shoes now. I'm his client, not his supervisor. He's independently elected, and his job is to promote, among other things, to protect the public and to engage in consumer protection. And if he believes there is some fraud or financial fraud that might have been committed upon the people, to do his due diligence to investigate. And from what I have read and what I have seen, that's what he's trying to do. But I don't have all the facts on what he may or may not know about what's happened at the University of Virginia.
UVA has already spent $350,000 defending itself from his request. Do you have any idea how much it would have cost in the AG's office?
No, because most of the costs are essentially sunk costs. So there's about 350, 60 people down there that handle multiple cases all the time. So it's unfortunate the university spent that much. But listen, these same things happen regularly where attorneys, and listen, I did that as Attorney General. I made various demands. Sometimes the respondent wanted to cooperate and handed over materials. And sometimes they didn't, and they had access to the court. Same with Freedom of Information Act and a number of other demands. So I would say, while this got a lot of press, Bob, I would say to you that this is part of the ordinary course of business that the Attorney General's office does on a regular basis. At any point in time, they're handling literally thousands of cases and hundreds of subpoenas and investigative demands. And obviously, because it had to do with the issue of global warming, it probably got more attention than it might have otherwise had. But I will certainly, the Attorney General is independently elected to discharge his constitutional duties, and I assume that's what he's trying to do.
You're listening to Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. My guest is Governor Bob McDonnell. Let's get back to our phone calls. Our next caller is Randolph in Orange. Randolph, welcome to Assembly Conversations.
Good evening, Governor.
Hi, Randolph.
I'd like to thank WTF for making it possible for this opportunity to speak to you.
Sure.
I hope we can be as generous in the Assembly with NPR and this wonderful station. I'm calling concerned about the future of primary health care in the Commonwealth. I'm a rural family doctor. I returned home after my family practice residency about 23 years ago, and I practice in Orange, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
As one of many primary care physicians with some specialist helps who are running free clinics, I ask how you feel we should proceed to provide primary care to all of our citizens in the Commonwealth. Do you believe all citizens should have access to primary care? I know I teach for several institutions, and I have a hard time convincing medical students to come spend a month with me to even consider family medicine or one of the other primary care specialties. Our numbers are in serious decline, and I know you know, there are attacks on the new health care reform issue, whether it's constitutional or not, to require all citizens have health care. I don't know how we're going to get there. But I'd like your thoughts and reflection on especially primary care in the Commonwealth. Thanks for your time, Governor, and God bless everybody there.
Hey, well, Randolph, thanks for your call and for your comments, especially your service as a doctor. It's an extraordinary long, expensive, and laborious road to get your medical license, and especially practicing as a primary care doc. You are the gateway into the healthcare system for most. My brother's an internist and know a little bit about what he's gone through. Couple things. One, just briefly on the federal health care bill, I don't believe it's constitutional. That's why we sued and won in federal court. Of course, the Florida court also ruled yesterday that it is not constitutional to force a citizen of the United States to buy a product of insurance or, if not, to get fined. That's not what the Commerce Clause permits. So I think that while the goals might have been noble in the federal health care bill, the means that they have chosen is not right, nor is it constitutional. With regard to the practical aspects of getting people care, I will say that access to medical care, particularly in some of the rural areas of the state, I said, I noted you practice in Orange County, is a critically important issue. We've had a physician and a nursing shortage in many areas in Virginia for quite some time. I'm really delighted that Carilion has started a medical school with Virginia Tech now this year, their first class, that they're going to focus on rural health care. I think Liberty University also is looking at starting a new medical school. The Virginia College of Osteopathic Medicine down in southwest Virginia that graduates about 140 docs a year, also with a mission of providing, in that case, primarily primary care docs in the rural area, gives me a great deal of hope that the challenges that that you've faced are going to be met with expanding the opportunities for primary docs now and with more medical schools in Virginia. So I hope that'll help us a lot.
Thank you, Randolph. Thank you very much for your call and your question. Governor, we're about a minute from our next break, so let me ask you a quick question. Delegates today advanced legislation to require at least 150 hours of phys ed per week in kindergarten through eighth grade. Is that a healthy measure?
I wish they'd require it for me. I'd be a lot more motivated to exercise. You know, there's so many demands on teachers and curriculum. We've got to teach math, science, and any number of other things. But people that are not healthy, you know, ultimately don't have access to the American dream. So I think it's important. How that balances out with the other requirements, I'd have to take a look at.
You're listening to Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Governor Bob McDonnell is my guest. We'll be right back after this short break.
Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Assembly Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
Welcome back to Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. I'm your host, Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership at the University of Virginia. Governor Bob McDonnell is my guest for the next half hour. Give us a call at 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397 if you have a question for Governor Bob McDonnell. Let's go back to our callers. Our next caller is Phoebe in Harrisonburg. Welcome, Phoebe. You're on Assembly Conversations.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have to give you a little story first to frame my question. When I was a junior in high school, we had to do a project on an engineering feat that also had a sociological change on the area, and I chose the Virginia Bay Bridge. And what struck me when I went over there, and this is about 10 years or so ago, with how economically depressed the area was after the fact that they got this great bridge that was going to change everything. Charlestown was not really economically progressive or anything like that. And I thought that the toll was a real problem. if it was just a free access road, I feel like Virginia's peninsula would be a huge tourist destination, especially the lower end for Virginians. And framing my question, I would like you, Governor McDonald, to explain to me how your proposal for tolls across Virginia are going to help those areas that are going to be affected by the tolls, because I can see how that toll has directly affected the economic progress of the Eastern Shore.
Thank you, Phoebe. Thanks for your call and your question. Governor?
Hey, Phoebe, thanks for calling in. I appreciate it. I would say a couple things. I think there are any number of reasons that that bridge was built. It wasn't all about economic development. It was, frankly, just in large measure, just about the practical way of getting from the mid-Atlantic part of the United States up through Maryland, Delaware, and those places a little bit faster. So spanning that 22 miles over the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay was a practical consideration, not just about economic development for the shore. But on the larger question, tolls are used all over America as a user fee. It is truly the consummate user fee. You use a road, you pay for it. And there are obviously no free lunches when it comes to government services. Road construction and bridge construction is very expensive. It's paid for through gas tax, sales tax, tolls, and different mechanisms, bonds, different mechanisms like that. But in certain areas, Phoebe, I think where we can put a toll on without hampering the flow of traffic, and where we can get the engagement of the private sector to leverage our scarce resources so that we pay, let's say, 20 or 25% of the project, the public sector, private sector pays the other 75, 80%, and then levies a toll to pay the debt service on the bonds. It's a creative way, especially in tough fiscal times, to be able to get road projects built. So there are a couple projects on 95, in the Midtown Tunnel, on Route 460, and some other things that I think will allow us to build roads that we otherwise wouldn't be able to build. And especially now with speed passes and things like that, really not encumber the driver, but to charge, you know, a reasonable fee for the price of the road. So I think it's part of the overall strategy. I certainly don't intend to have tolls all over the state, but in certain areas, I think it makes sense.
Greg had a question as a merchant asking about internet sales taxes. Is there going to be a change?
I doubt it. Now, there are some who would propose that either to state or the federal level. We have tried to keep the internet to be a tax-free medium for exchange in order to continue to expand electronic commerce in Virginia. We pride ourselves as really being one of the homes of the internet in Virginia, with AOL and other great companies located in Northern Virginia. A significant amount of the world's internet traffic goes through Virginia, and so generally, when you tax something, you end up reducing the amount of the use of that product or service. So it's not something I think this General Assembly would support, or I.
Let's try our next caller. That's Tyler in Henrico County. Tyler, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with Governor Bob McDonnell.
Well, hey, I won't waste your time asking for something. Everybody seems to be asking the governor for something tonight. I wanted to offer...
I think we just lost him.
I was waiting for his offer. That might have been something good for me.
He was talking about Virginia's Defense Force, which I think was the topic of another ruling by the Attorney General in the last week, saying that Virginia can fund its own Defense Force, or it can go with the federal system it has now. What are your thoughts?
Well, the Virginia Defense Force is authorized by statute at virtually no cost to the taxpayers, unlike the National Guard that we fully train, equip, and pay for out of state and federal dollars, primarily federal dollars. But the Defense Force is part of the old Virginia militia that is made up of some extraordinary people, volunteers who regularly train with virtually no compensation, Bob. So it's an extraordinarily patriotic thing that they do. With regard to the other ruling, obviously the federal legislature has repealed their don't ask, don't tell policy. I don't think we can have two systems, one for the National Guard and one for the federal government. We don't have regulations yet that have been promulgated by the United States government in terms of what that repeal scenario is going to look like. But I don't think we can have one set of rules for the National Guard that they have in peacetime and then one they'd have to adopt when they go and deploy as part of the federal forces in Iraq or Afghanistan or some other place. So whatever the regulations are, I certainly would expect the our National Guard to comply with those.
Governor Bob McDonnell is my guest on Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. If you'd like to ask a question of the governor, give us a call at 1-866-611-NEWS. That is 866-611-6397. Our next caller is, I believe, Rodney in Amherst. Rodney, are you with us, and do you have a question for Governor Bob McDonnell?
I do, and Governor, thank you for appearing on the show and for taking my call, and thank you to WVTF and Public Radio for making this
Thanks,
service
Rodney.
Available. Governor, my question revolves around training centers, and specifically, Delegate Klein had a bill that would have required General Assembly approval before the closure of any training center. Central Virginia Training Center in Amherst County is the county, one of, and perhaps the county's largest employer. Has several of the buildings have recently been renovated and brought up to code. A lot have not. In one of the discussions, I think when Delegate Klein's bill was killed recently in committee, there was an indication that there may be a plan to close all the training centers. And I know what a vital service they provide to some of our just most needy citizens that live there and have been there all their lives. And I think that's the questions that have gone on for years and years about what's the future, what's the end game for facilities like CBTC that leaves the parents just in turmoil and the families and the caregivers. What are your thoughts, and what do you see as the long term for facilities like CBTC?
Well, thank you for your call on that. These are some of the most difficult to serve citizens that we have, with extraordinary physical and sometimes mental handicaps, and that's why the training centers were put together many, many years ago, is to facilitate good quality, compassionate care for these Virginians, and particularly I know parents that have kids in there, both young and old children, value the services. Now, here's the challenge. Many of them, and you pointed it out absolutely correctly, many of them are not in as good a physical shape as they need to be. They're obviously extraordinarily expensive to run. Based on the United States Supreme Court's decision in Olmstead, and based on our recent Inspector General report, and frankly, based on a bill that I carried in the General Assembly 12 years ago, there is a clear policy in our state that we should, in every case possible, try to move people to the least restrictive area of care that fits their need. And so what we are trying to do is to close as much as we can institutions where people are receiving care and move as many people as possible to community-based care, where they're closer to their families and where they receive maybe more extensive services at a lower cost. So that is our long-term goal, but we certainly don't want to do it in a way that jeopardizes the health of any of our most vulnerable citizens. So it's going to be a long-term process of changing or closing these centers. But I do think it should be a clinical decision, not a legislative decision. And Dr. Bill Hazel, who's my Secretary of Health and Human Resources, is working on this exact situation to make sure that we can make this good transition that's both required medically and legally, but do it in a way that respects the dignity of these patients.
Thank you, Rodney. Thanks for your call and your question. Next week, Assembly Conversations will feature a program on mental health needs in Virginia. Let's get back to the phones. Our next caller, I believe, is Becky in Lexington. Becky, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with Governor Bob McDonnell.
Thank you very much, and I'm happy that public radio provides such a forum. Thank you. My question is, let me just preface it by saying that I am a native Virginian. My family came here in the 1700s, and I was born here, yet I have lived in cities, New York and Los Angeles primarily, centers of at least self-perceived sophistication. And I moved back here recently to be near family and found out, to my chagrin, that Virginia has the highest rate of executions after the state of Texas. And I don't think of Virginia that way. I've never thought of Virginia as some sort of backwater where killing people was a sport, as it seems to be in Texas. I mean, Texas is the brunt of a great deal of humor because of their tendencies to be like that. And I'm just wondering how Virginia came to be in this situation in an age when we should perhaps be getting away from killing, whether in war or in prisons or on the streets.
Thank you, Becky. Thanks for your call and your question, Governor.
Hey, Becky, thanks for the call, and welcome back to Virginia. We're glad to have you. You raised the difficult question of capital punishment. Is it justified and under what circumstances? I would say I have a different view than you do. Having been a prosecutor early in my career, I am a supporter of capital punishment. We have specific, limited circumstances in which capital punishment can be meted out in Virginia, and it's always the killing of a person under certain circumstances in the course of a robbery, in the course of a rape, killing more than two people, in the course of a terrorist activity. So we don't allow the death penalty in all cases. It's a select number of murder cases. I believe personally that it is an appropriate and just punishment in certain cases. Virginia does enforce the law. We also make sure that every capital defendant has qualified, trained, free capital defense lawyers that are equipped with virtually every resource that they might need to defend the person that has been accused of capital punishment. But the majority of Virginians do support capital punishment. I can say we take no pride in or pleasure in executing people. It is a matter of justice, and we do have life without parole as an option for judges and juries to sentence, but we also permit the option for execution in Virginia, and I support that, and the majority of Virginians do as well. So we have had a number of executions since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976, but we only do it in for the most heinous circumstances and the most heinous types of crimes.
Governor, why do you think Texas and Virginia are so far ahead of the numbers of the rest of the country, the rest of the states, in executions?
A couple things. One, we're among the most populous states. Texas is in the top five. Virginia is 12, I think, in terms of the population. So we're larger states. Secondly, I would say to you that Virginia has some of the lower crime rates, and it's because we do believe in tough punishment, not just capital punishment. That's a very rare circumstance. But we have very tough sentences. We have no parole, and people know they're going to get a fair trial, but if they're convicted, they're going to be punished severely in Virginia. And as a part or result of that, I think we've got some relatively low crime rates. But we have done some things over the years with habeas corpus reform and other procedural reforms that have facilitated a fair and quicker process of handling appeals and so forth. But, the people of Virginia are the ones that generally decide the death sentence because they're the ones that sit on the jury. And in most of those cases, they have the option, if they find somebody guilty of capital punishment, of life or death. And so the citizens, back to the Magna Carta in 1215, the jury of your peers is the one that judges you. And in Virginia, juries have elected to execute people for horrible crimes against fellow citizens, and I support that.
You know, it's interesting. Texas is number one by a good margin. Number two, ahead of Virginia, if it were a state, is Harris County, Texas. Mm. The rest of Texas is number one. Harris County, Texas would be number two, and Virginia would be number three.
I had not heard that statistic.
In the nation in executions. Let's get back to our callers on Assembly Conversations. Governor Bob McDonnell is my guest. Our next caller is Jason in Danville. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Jason.
Hello. I am calling from Southern Virginia, probably one of the places that has been hardest hit by this recession. We have a poverty rate of 24% here in Danville. Martinsville has an unemployment rate of 20%, probably more. And I was really worried about how maybe Southern Virginia is going to get lost in the shuffle between all these the cuts. What are the plans to ensure that Southern Virginia can be brought back up to where the rest of Virginia is during this hard economic time?
Jason, it's a great question. I've been spending an enormous amount of time in Southern and Southwest Virginia. I was actually down. I flew to Brunswick County yesterday to meet with education and business leaders. I've assigned a full-time Deputy Secretary of Economic Development for rural Virginia, first one in history. I have promised that the Lieutenant Governor or I will be on the ground in Southern Virginia every 30 days meeting with leaders until we can help to turn the process around. I have focused a number of economic development projects in Southern Virginia. In fact, the Microsoft project that we just landed in Mecklenburg County of $500 million data centers, the largest capital investment in the history of Southern Virginia. We've been working very closely with the Tobacco Commission that has got literally hundreds of millions of dollars for investment in Southern and Southwest Virginia to help take the place of the old of the tobacco industry that obviously has been depleted somewhat over the last 12 years. And you correctly point out, Jason, that Martinsville, Danville have some of the highest unemployment rates in the state, double digits, chronic double digit unemployment rate, because over the last 12 years with tobacco, furniture manufacturing, textiles, and others, a lot of jobs that were the staple of Southern Virginia have gone offshore. We're aggressively trying to repatriate some of those businesses. Our Department of Economic Development is focusing a lot of our economic development efforts down there. We've gotten some great partnerships in around Danville and Martinsville with the Chambers of Commerce marketing themselves as a region. We put money into economic development mega sites to be able to attract new business down there. We've created five energy centers around Southern and Southwest Virginia through the Tobacco Commission. And I can only tell you that I really am focused on trying to reduce those unemployment rates. Now, the good news is it's falling slightly. Virginia's gone from 7.6 down to 6.7% unemployment since I've become governor. We're well below the national rate at 9.4. But, you know, as long as there's 275,000 Virginians that can't find work, it is a significant crisis and burden for me, and that's why I'm asking for another $55 million from the General Assembly this year for economic development incentives to be able to help you.
You're listening to Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Governor Bob McDonnell is my guest. Governor, what are the chances for ABC store privatization this year, and if it doesn't pass in the Assembly this year, would you bring it back?
Yeah, absolutely. It's tough. It's a big change, Bob. And big changes in a conservative state sometimes are difficult to make, but it's the right thing to do. It's the only legal product that we've got a government monopoly over. 32 other states have already privatized. Five more are following Virginia and trying to privatize. We've got the highest government tax in the country, 69% tax on distilled spirits. So all I'm trying to do is say, look, the free markets work fine. We've been distributing beer and wine since the repeal of prohibition in private stores. And there's no reason, and we, you know, Bob, we have 7,000 beer and wine licenses in Virginia, but for artificial reasons, we only have 333 stores where you can distribute, you know, bourbon or vodka. And look, and I don't drink hard liquor myself, but I think those that want to ought to have a choice. So we have a good bill that expands it to 1,000 stores in the free market. It won't be really new stores. It'll be new shelf space at a Walmart or a 7-Eleven or a Jay's Beer and Wine or Costco or something like that. It can be done in a responsible way, generate $300 million for transportation, another $13 million on an ongoing basis for schools and roads. So I'm committed to it. It's going to be tough sledding, honestly. Legislators still have some questions about it, but I think it's the right thing to do, and I'll continue to pursue it.
Let's get back to our callers. Our next caller is Eric in Blacksburg. Eric, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with Governor Bob McDonnell.
Yes, hello, Governor.
Hi, Eric.
Hello. I'm calling about a bill that's before the General Assembly right now. It's H.J. 557, and it concerns the Federal Reserve System. And this bill was submitted by Delegate Bob Marshall. The reason why I'm calling is that the Federal Reserve System has had some issues of concern of stability. you know, since 1971, the dollar has been delinked from gold, and so the dollar has been a pure fiat currency based just upon the faith in the U.S. government. And the fiat dollar has been used to bail out foreign central banks. And, basically the concern here is that no fiat currency in the history of the world has lasted longer than 40 years. And coming up in August of this year, the dollar will be a 40-year-old fiat currency. And I think Bob Marshall shares similar concerns about this, and he has a bill to possibly investigate coining a Virginia currency in the event of a breakdown of the Federal Reserve System. Now, I heard a recent commentary that you thought that this type of bill would be unconstitutional, and I'd be interested to hear, if you believe so, what grounds do you think it's unconstitutional, and what would be your alternative to what Bob Marshall is suggesting?
Well, the alternative is we have a United States government who is cloaked with the duty of printing and maintaining currency under Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution. I fully agree with you that we all should have healthy concerns about the fiscal health of the United States of America. We're $14 trillion in debt. We've been growing with deficit spending of over $1 trillion a year. Spending at the federal level is out of control, and we have a mess. I realized that when I got to be governor, and we slashed spending back to 2006 levels, and now we've got a surplus. So I really do believe we need to control spending to be able to maintain the health of our system. So that's my concern about the debt and deficits of the federal government. I just think that it is not the duty of the states to be able to print their own currency. I think what we need to do is to make sure we elect people to the United States Congress and the United States Senate that will bolster the health of our fiscal system and quit spending in this way that is leveraging our children's future and get the country back on track. That's the solution.
Didn't we try printing our own currency some while back?
I think there may have been times in the past that we may have done that, but I haven't looked at the details of the delegates' bill. I can't opine necessarily today on whether or not there's any constitutional authority in the Virginia Constitution for our own currency. But I would say to you that I'm a strong believer in the 10th Amendment. I think the federal government does too much that should be left up to the provinces of the state. But it's very clear in the United States Constitution that one of their duties that they're supposed to do and do well is to maintain a currency.
Our next caller, and I hope he is still with us because he's on I-81, is Mike. So, Mike, if you're still with us from I-81, you're on Assembly Conversations with Governor Bob McDonnell.
Thank you, Governor. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Mike.
Just as real quick, maybe you could give me some advice or some numbers or anything like that where you can help me, yourself being an attorney. My son, he's a teenager now. He's 18 years old now. When he was about 16, he got in some problems and was convicted of attempted rape and stuff like that. And now, thank God, he's doing real good. He's down in Bon Air, down in Richmond. He finished high school, and he's attending college. My question is there anything that we could do? Because in Virginia, you have to register as an offender. Even if you're a minor, then turn adult, you still have to register as an offender. And I have a bad taste in my mouth about the case of what the police did and everything. And it's a long story, but, you know, I know you don't have a lot of time. Is there anything I could do in reference to about trying to appeal or trying to talk to somebody in reference to the offender type thing when he becomes an adult?
Governor, if you can take it from there.
Yeah, I would say I certainly don't want to give legal advice, even though I am an attorney. I certainly hesitate to do that without knowing all the facts of a case, and certainly as governor, that's not my job. So certainly private legal counsel would be in order. What I will say is we do have, for serious offenders, we do have a sex offender registry for those who have committed sex offenses or offenses against minors that are required to register, and then we publicize that on a website so, frankly, our citizens can know whether or not they've got an offender that's perpetrated a significant crime that lives in their neighborhood so they can govern themselves accordingly and protect themselves. I would say that there are provisions in the code where there is access to the courts to be able to be removed from the registry. There is a certain number of years after the passage of which they can be removed from that registry. But we have created that over many years for the purposes of public awareness, public information, and public protection. And I have supported that policy.
Our next caller is Joanne in Nellisford, Virginia. Joanne, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with Governor Bob McDonnell.
Thank you, Governor. A quick question about the bonds. Virginia has enjoyed triple A-rated status of their bond issues, and I was wondering if we were going to be able to maintain that in the future.
Absolutely. And thanks for calling. How's things at beautiful Wintergreen? I hope it's beautiful up there.
Absolutely. It's we're going to get some more snow, I hope.
That's great. Yeah, I traveled to New York with the committee leaders in the House and the Senate, Republicans and Democrats, about 3 months ago. Met with the bond rating agencies. They are bullish on Virginia. They are supportive of what we're doing with the bond package. Delighted we're taking on the road projects. And I'm confident that what we're doing this year will be well received, and we will maintain our AAA bond rating.
Governor, our time is up for this edition of Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Thank you for coming on the program with us.
Thank you, Bob.
Taking calls across the state.
Glad to do it.
I'm your host, Bob Gibson of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership at UVA, saying thanks for joining us.
Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.